My guest Philip Schultz's poetry is deceptively simple. His poems often minutely observe the details of everyday life, but those become the vehicle to deeper concerns, such as mortality, shame, and self-sabotage. Yet they're lightened by his ever-present wry humor. Using humor, irony, and celebration as ballast against the book's darker forces, his new collection, Luxury, explores the comfort and sustenance of life, the bittersweet clarity of aging, and the anxieties of existence. Tony Hoagland said of Philip Schultz that he's one of the least affected of American poets and one of the fiercest. Schultz lives in East Hampton, New York, and is the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York City. Well, Philip Schultz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
I just loved this new poetry volume, Luxury. The title poem, Luxury, I'd like to talk about a little bit later, that really takes up almost half of the book. But first, just to say that in a general sense, the theme of mortality seems ever-present. You write that the end is taking me somewhere the beginning never wanted me to be. Talk about the sense of mortality that infuses the work of this book. And I have to say, it's not a glum book by any means. It's quite inspiring.
Well, you know, that line, I couldn't end that poem. This is from the Westerns, right? I remember not being able to know where that poem was going. I'm remembering back in being a boy in Rochester, New York, and how all my friends were basically first-generation immigrant kids in the inner city, and we Saturday morning go to the RKO and sit in the balcony. And it was going back to my beginning and remembering trying to look forward. But I couldn't end the poem, and I had an idea what it was about. And out of absolute frustration, ready to give up on it, I ended up almost hating it, as I do many, because I don't know where it's taking me. I start by wanting to be the boss, the director. And then I realize it's just the opposite. In order to go anywhere worthwhile, I'm the one being led. I'm the follower. And then that line appeared. And I remember how odd it made me feel. So I was in the same place you are in asking that. I recognized that it was genuine. It was felt. It was heartfelt. And that it made sense in the context of the poem. But I wasn't entirely comfortable in saying that out loud. You know, I mean, on the surface, it's sensible that when we start out, we're young, we're always going to be young, everything is always ahead of us, and suddenly, one day, there's more behind than there is ahead, and it takes us by surprise. And I didn't know I felt that way. And I didn't know the poem was going there, or to some extent about that. That the Westerns were such a large part of my youth, watching that, the romance with the American rhapsody, I call it, the American ideal, was somehow tarnished in some way. That I reached a point where it wasn't an ideal. So, I mean, that is where the line came from. It's sometimes, if you push hard enough, what you find, what you come to, is what you've been feeling all along but haven't yet realized. And that is a dark line, in a way.
A dark line.
Well, yes. The idea of not realizing one's mortality or what it is. I remember one friend, I show my work to some friends and they return the favor. But commenting on that line, not being sure if he liked that line. And I did, and it made sense, and others did. But I understood he's older than I am, and I think he was taking that even more seriously than it does make you ask yourself that question, doesn't it?
Exactly. There's also not just an awareness of, you know, where you began and where you may go, but also an awareness of the fragility of the future, not just personally, but in general, I felt in this cycle of poems. I mean, I'm sure a lot of us have been thinking about, you know, the situation we're in as a society, and the future does seem very fragile to us. And it seems there was some of that in this book.
Well, when you're going through a dark time, it forces you to take a lot into, you know, to keep one eye on the road behind, on the rearview mirror. You're looking, you're trying to get somewhere, and you're driving to extend that metaphor, but you're also interested in where you're coming from and what's behind you. In my sense, I have two sons. I have two young men with their world ahead of them, their lives ahead of them. Mm-hmm. And it makes me feel particularly vulnerable because of this political situation and having someone out of control in the White House who represents everything negative and conceited, vainglorious. And that, I mean, it's one thing for myself, but it's another thing for them. I mean, if he can affect their future. And there's a kind of helplessness involved. I mean, how much control do I have over that? Very little.
You also have a wonderful poem about the links between immigrants, past and present. The poem is Greed, and I loved it. I wonder if you might be willing to read that for us.
Sure.
Greed. My ocean town struggles to pick up leaves, offer summer school, and keep our library open. Every day now, more men stand at the railroad station, waiting to be chosen for work. Because it's thought the Hispanics will work for less, they get picked first, while the whites and blacks avoid each other's eyes. Our handyman, Santos, who expects only what his hands earn, is proud of his half acre in Guatemala, where he plans to retire. His desire to proceed with dignity is admirable, but he knows that now no one retires. Everyone works harder. My father imagined a life more satisfying than the one he managed to lead. He didn't see himself as uneducated, thwarted, or bitter, but soon to be rich. Being rich was his right, he believed. Happiness, I used to think, was a necessary illusion. Now I think it's just precious moments of relief, like dreams of Guatemala. Sometimes at night in winter, surrounded by the significant silence of empty mansions, which once were cottages where people lived their lives and are now owned by banks and the absent rich, I like to stand at my window looking for a TV's futile flickering, always surprised to see, instead, the quaint, porous face of my reflection, immersed in darkness, its one abundance.
One of the things I really like about your poetry is that poem starts, you know, very prosaically in the real sense of the term, you know, like prose, but the rhythm of it gathers, and as it goes deeper, it starts on a very kind of quotidian level and ends on a very introspective level.
Right. And again, that surprised me, that ending. You know, in winter out here, we're surrounded by darkness. I mean, mostly houses that no one lives in, or they come in the summer, or the occasional weekend or holidays, but you can't even see a light in a window. And all around, you look up and down the street, you see maybe 8 houses away on the left side, you see a light, but it's kind of isolated, and it's a strange feeling at night because we live here. Mm-hmm. This is our home, but a lot of people, their summer homes.
And we should say we're really in the heart of the town, of the village of East Hampton here. It should be a place where all the houses are occupied all the time.
Well, when I first moved here in 1990, people did live here. And this was one family, and he was the town postmaster, the town mailman for all his life. So this is a two-family house. And he died here, and his name was Schott. It's close to Schultz, Schott. And the house was built in 1927, and it's interesting. It was a different neighborhood then. They were all cottages. This was a cottage we added on as our family grew, the whole half of the house. But now they knocked down all these cottages, and they built McMansions that go to within 10 feet on either side of the property line. And no yards, and they're empty. Some of them are unsold, some of them are bought and they're going to be sold, or some of them people just live in a few months a year.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Philip Schultz about his latest poetry collection, Luxury. And yet there's another aspect of this place, its beauty, which you just, with stunning imagery, express in this wonderful collection of poems, Luxury. For example, I love the imagery on page 31 in which you say that everything lives in the eye and the ear. Maybe let's take a look at that poem,
too. That's the title poem, right? Yes. Oh, no, that's the Welcome to the Springs.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. The poem is an elegy for a very good friend of mine who was a poet and an art critic and the literary editor of the East Hampton Star. I'll read the last part of the poem. Okay. What role did I play that last? He died of cancer. What role did I play that last night? Watching you high on morphine, drop cigarettes into your lap, swooning inside a cancer and cold train, stained oblivion. What can I do, you asked. There's nothing I can do. Well, what didn't you do? Chauffeuring James Brown from Harlem to Montauk, high on Librium, you got from a Chelsea speed freak, cooking your manic bouillabaisse stuffed with half the Atlantic Ocean, spoon dancing Getz and Bud Powell, swollen with vodka and dreams of Venice, your dinner riffs to Li Po, Machado, and Blake. How I liked your stories of you, a gay teenager, wandering among your MoMA pals, Goya, Rauschenberg, and Francis Bacon, learning to hide inside art's ecstatic parentheses. In any case, it's March, warm and wet and windy, and this is where I live, here, where everything lives in the eye and ear, and a silky frenzy steeps the wetlands in testimony, in praise, where the meaning calls of osprey ricochet between the loquacious silence of the dunes and the cleansing sweep of moonlight, where the souls of the dispersed dead pass, making and remaking their silhouettes, one luminous lost imagination at a time.
That's so beautiful.
It took 10 years to write this poem.
Say more about that.
It's a somewhat complicated story. I didn't write poetry for over 15 years, and there were 18 years between books. When I met Monica, I started again. We moved out here, and I was happy not writing, but suddenly, you know, I was in love, and there was a wedding, and I started writing poetry, and I met Robert he ran the reading series at Guildhall and the other things, and he was my first poetry friend in 18 years. Robert Long, a wonderful poet and a cook and a jazz aficionado. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Koonings Bicycle, which is about the art history of the East End. I mean, he really knew everything. Anyway, he was a very good friend. And I forgot the original. What was the question?
Why did it take you so many years to write this book?
Well, I was showing him I would show him my poetry. He would show me his. And I was showing him Failure, the long poem in Failure, which is my most successful book. And
that's an irony.
Yeah, I know. Failure won a book. Yes, my most successful book called Failure. And out of nowhere, he died. He was like a couple weeks before 52, very young, unexpected, cancer. And I realized that I didn't know what the poem was about, and I kept writing it, and it didn't work. And it got longer and shorter, and it didn't work. And his grave is around the corner from me. It's buried in a Catholic cemetery around the corner. And every now and then, since he really introduced me to East End, he grew up here. He was friends with Lisa de Kooning and part of that whole scene. And I was, in many ways, new. So he would show me shortcuts and tell me about the history of this place, and all that was important. And in many ways, all the stuff that I'm writing about, East Hampton and all of that, is like proof that I finally belong here, that I live here. Because he said that he liked my work, but I wasn't yet writing about East Hampton, and he wanted me to. And one day I was visiting his grave and just catching him up. I realized I started cursing him and being angry. And I was shocked. Realized how angry I was that he had died. He broke this contract. We were helping each other reemerge as poets. He had stopped writing, I had, and he broke the contract. And I think how it works psychologically is that I was so guilty about being angry at a friend dying that I buried it. And when I buried it, I couldn't write the poem. So off and on for 10 years, I tried to write this poem. I hated the poem. It was this huge struggle. But as soon as I realized the anger, the line in the poem that deals with it is, Monica's new sculpture has grown darker as you said it would. Eli is happy at Amherst, and Augie likes to write. What a surprise. Well, I've forgiven you, finally, for not living to see the book you helped me write get published. Only now do I understand that. It's not the resentment I regret. It's the shame. So once I realized that, I came home and wrote it quickly. You can't write a poem until you really know the truth about how you feel and can connect to it. And if you're ashamed or guilty about how you're feeling, you repress it. So there's no poem. And I had lived with this guilt for being angry at him for dying for 10 years. So it was a hard poem to write.
And so much of your work, you know, you said your most successful book was Failure. And the last time we spoke with you, the title of that book was The God of Loneliness.
Everybody, by the way, except for my wife, told me not to call the book Failure. No one is going to buy a book called Failure.
And yet they did. And, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's like connected to what you just said before. You can't write a poem until you know what it's about, until you really understand, until you can speak in a true voice. And so many people do read, I mean, people read poetry to uncover that truthful voice. And we all deal with failure and shame and loneliness.
Right. I mean, that's exactly true. I think that's what you want to find when you go to your poetry. I was reading Lorca. There's a new wonderful translation, and I was just reading all his early poems, especially like the Gypsy Ballads and the Spanish poems, not the New York poems. And God, it was just a fountain of feeling and enthusiasm and love of music and all of that. I think when you go to poetry, you want to be opened up. You want to know what you're really feeling, what your experience. Sometimes we experience things in a delayed way because unless we know how we're feeling about it, we don't possess what just happened. You write poetry to possess it, to own it. and people go read it for the same reason.
To own and possess the feeling.
Yes. Or the experience of something. I mean, sometimes automatically people just repress death, you know, loss. It's too painful, and you survive it by burying it. And yet you know something's wrong and unfair about burying something too deeply.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Philip Schultz, poet Philip Schultz, about his most recent collection of poetry. It's called Luxury. And Luxury is now, let's talk about Luxury. It is the title poem. It also makes up about half of the book, and it really focuses on the theme of suicide. So tell us a little bit about what moved you to write this very long poem.
Well, I turned 70, and my wife and sons took me on a trip to, they arranged a trip to Cuba, and a place I very much always wanted to visit. And when we were there, I made a thing about wanting to visit Hemingway's house. And we did, and it was quite something. It's so fragile, they don't let you inside. You just have to peer through the windows at all the rooms and everything, because it can't take people, hordes of people passing through. And I was just terribly moved. At one point, I remember my wife saying to me, I never looked happier. And I, since I was a boy, I loved Hemingway's work, and Hemingway died, killed himself, less than a year before my father's died. He died of a heart attack. But in my 17-year-old mind, he was a suicide, because his doctor called me into his office and said, your father is working himself to death. He had a stroke, and if he doesn't stop working and go into a hospital, he's going to die soon.
And what was your answer to the doctor?
We don't get along. I mean, it was the last thing. It's quite a responsibility to give a 17-year-old. And he said, he won't listen to me or your mother. Only you could save him now. So in my mind, and I didn't realize this until I wrote this poem, that I was supposed to save my father's life and didn't, failed at it. And that was the first failure. And then I had other friends, another very dear friend who ended up killing himself. And my job was to try to save him also. So it took me a long time. I came back from Cuba, and I started to write what I thought was a short poem about visiting Hemingway's house. I have other poems about other Hemingway houses. And out of that came the understanding that I had linked in my 17-year-old mind Hemingway's death with my father's, and then I was writing about my friend Ralph. And that led to Paul Celan, another suicide.
And tell us who he was.
Paul Celan was a great Holocaust poet, the greatest of all of them, the way Primo Levi was a great nonfiction, fiction writer of it. But Paul Celan was a great, who lived with it as long as he could. And I was introduced to Paul Celan by this friend, Ralph, in graduate school. He had just translated his most famous poem, Death Fugue, in Daedalus, a very prestigious magazine. And he was being shown off by the director and the heads of the program. It was my first year and his second. And a fuss was being made, and I, of course, was attracted to that. And we became friends, and he introduced me. He was half black, biracial, white mother, black father. And it was interesting because he introduced me to all the Jewish poets. I'm Jewish. He wanted to be a Jewish man of letters, a Jewish intellectual. Isaac Babel, Yehuda Amichai, who became a close friend, Mendelstam, all these, and Paul Celan. And which was kind of ironic. And I had grown up in an inner city, and there were many blacks living, neighbors and people I identified with. So I felt at home with him, and he felt at home with me. We became best friends for many years. And he had a darkness in him that I and others tried to spare him from, and it didn't work.
Yeah, and you pleaded with your friend, who you call R in Luxury. You pleaded with him to, you say, assent to rhapsody. What did he tell you in response?
Well, there was a conversation, and in the last conversation we had, he told me that I was always encouraging him to write, that I figured that writing for me was a form of salvation, and it should be for him too. And he was an incredibly gifted poet and musician. And sometimes in San Francisco, he would call up late, play something, and then hang up without saying hello or goodbye. And that was him. And he wrote music and all of that. So in this last conversation, I said, "Are you writing?" And he said, "No." And I asked why. And he said, "Because every time he tried to write, a black bird would appear on his shoulder and tell him," he called it a bird, "tell him that he was worthless and that everything he would write would be worthless. It was useless." And then he said, on the other shoulder, he heard my voice telling him that he's gifted and that he should write and all of that. And he then told me that the bird had won. It's too persuasive. I pleaded with him to listen, and he basically said he didn't call to be saved. He called to say goodbye. I didn't realize any of this until I was writing all of this, and it felt like the last piece of the puzzle, putting it all together. I have a school of writing called a writer studio, and I guess I'm in, you know, it helps people. That's really what the purpose is. And one of the things we teach is that everyone has a shitbird, a negative force that is a negative voice, that if you go to a party, if you give a reading and the place is full, you only look at the ones who didn't come and get upset. The glass is always half empty. If you should rejoice, if there's something nice happens and you instead get depressed, it's your shitbird's voice. Everyone has one. And helping my students identify theirs helps them write, because then they can push it away. Its argument is always, they don't know, you can't do it, and it'll go, what's the sense of all of this? Because it won't go. Or they write something fantastic and they can't send it out, mm-hmm. because then they're afraid that somebody will publish it and that something bad will happen, that recognition will bring something, that they're ashamed of something. They're ashamed of the feelings. And maybe they've written about their mother or their father or their girlfriend, and maybe they'll see it. Whatever. But I actually didn't realize it, but the school I created, a crazy idea. I mean, I left a paying job, a good with benefits, to do something where I didn't make a dime for several years, and because I had to. And one of the things I was always talking about was a shitbird. So if you get what I'm saying, it's been a linear line that propels me.
Now, you've talked about your father, you've talked about your friend Ralph, you've talked about Paul Celan and Ernest Hemingway, all who appear as characters in this poem. They appear repeatedly in the poem Luxury, the title poem of your new book, your collection. So, Philip Schultz, what about yourself? Have you entertained thoughts of ending it?
Well, of course. I mean, when I was 20 and there was an attempt, I got a Dear John letter from a young woman that I was madly in love with and had left behind in the East, and I was in San Francisco living in an attic and just getting by. And I finally saved myself. But I tried. I actually, You know, what I mean by luxury, or actually what I mean by even suicide, is that existence is a luxury. But you have to somehow position yourself to appreciate it and see that. And you have to, sometimes you live in a fog. And it's really, the fog is so thick, it's hard for you to see where you are and how far you've come. Mm-hmm. And to be able to count your blessings. And, you know, Hemingway's father killed himself, and sometimes the children of suicides, it's something that's in the air. And I write about the fact that one of Hemingway's granddaughters once called me, and pretty much we discussed that because, you know, her grandfather and her great-grandfather both had done that. So I think really what it comes down to is that all of us are pretty much sometimes frozen at an intersection. And the intersection is one path, one roadway, is to affirm how far you've come and to is a path of appreciation. If not celebration, at least assessment and understanding that your life amounts to something. And the other path is a very dark one.
Yeah, you talk about the paradox of suicide, and you quote Camus saying that there is one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. What do you mean by that?
Well, what he meant is that just that the question of life or death is the most crucial question.
To be or not to be.
Yeah, right. And to, you know, it's more important than any other question. Mm-hmm. And when a person consciously or unconsciously takes themselves to the point where there's a dark force that they don't want to live anymore because they're suffering. My friend Ralph was just suffering. He couldn't take the pain anymore. He couldn't take any more humiliation or pain. That is such a crucial question that's the first question. Survival. You know, survival of the fittest, you know, we've met the enemy and he is us. Mm-hmm.
As Pogo said.
Yes, right. Well, we're up against that in ourselves. Yeah. We're the ability. The greatest talent, perhaps, is the one to be able to be appreciative of who you are and what you've done.
So what is the paradox of suicide?
Well, it's certainly absurd. You know, he was also Camus, I mean, pretty much the inventor of an understanding of absurdity. It was at the that things are beyond ironic, that they have a reality all their own, that they make almost no sense, and that's how they are sensible. You just have to accept that. And when you look at life, it is like that it's such an extreme effort to constantly feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and to get by and to find something that makes us feel that it's all worthwhile.
It's interesting just to hear you talk. When I was 40 years old, it's a bit of a while ago, I fell into just a kind of existential depression for no reason at all. I mean, I'd never been depressed before, and I really haven't been since. But it lasted 9 months, the gestational 9 months. And I found myself in a very beautiful place in Big Sur, California. I went there with my son. And I was on a hillside, and the sun was shining, and the colors were beautiful, and the smells of the sage were just overwhelming and gorgeous. And I felt, all of a sudden, I had an epiphany. And the epiphany was that whether I was going to be miserable or happy was my choice. And if I was going to be miserable, then there was no route out except to kill myself, because what's the point of living with such pain? And of course, because I had a child, that was a foreclosed path. So I better choose the other way, which was just simply to take what is and strive to find happiness with whatever I found myself. And it worked. I don't know why. I mean, it's an old lesson, but it's one that's difficult to really experience. It's easy to read about, but hard to experience. But it was really a moment of transformation.
Well, you know, a week ago, I gave my first reading. The book is brand new. I mean, I just came out. So this is my first interview, by the way. And I had my first reading, and I read from that poem. And during the book signing, I was surprised by the number of people who wanted to tell me stories like the one you just told me. That everyone, to some extent, has had that story or has known someone her. And they all had to tell me. And it didn't make any difference how many people were waiting behind them impatiently. They had to tell me. Some would grab my hand, and I had no idea what had just happened. And afterwards, I went to dinner with a number of friends, and they were telling me about their experiences. So it had opened up something.
Yes. At some point, we all confront that existential crisis.
Yes. I mean, and maybe have to and should, and because it's the real measure of who we are. And sometimes something goes wrong and leads to depression, which is very painful. We can't come out of it. We live in a bubble, a gloom, a fog. And it's really hard to fight your way out of it. But you have to give yourself enough to make the fighting out of it worthwhile.
So I'd just like to end this wonderful interview by you reading another poem. And that poem is entitled Three, because it is the third part of Luxury, on page 57.
Three, and it begins with a quote from Paul Celan. O one, O none, O no one, O you, where did the way lead when it led nowhere? Sometimes when something I fear cannot tolerate something I desire, I'll wince and shudder and shout out, as if confronted with an idea or thought or feeling I cannot accept. Then, at the center of a pause I never felt before, a voice will remind me of things I do poorly, mistakes I cannot forgive. Sometimes, unable to breathe or feel my hands or feet, a void inside me slowly fills with the sobriety and brilliance of shame. This is when a black bird perches on my shoulder, asking me to stop thinking, stop talking, and dreaming. To stop, simply just stop.
Well, Philip Schultz, thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.